This is iUniverse Radio, brought to you by iUniverse, the leading book marketing, editorial services, and supported self-publishing company. iUniverse Radio is your opportunity to hear firsthand from authors about their new books. It's an in-depth discussion about the author's passion about the development of his or her story in their own words. It's an inside look into the characters and the plot and how the story all came together. Here is iUniverse Radio with host Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Depth of Revenge, and the author is Richard Golden, and he joins us now on iUniverse Radio. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Steve.
Well, this is a submarine adventure story with a real today news twist, deals with Israel and Iran, and I'm sure it's a type of book that you can't put down.
I've taken it really right out of the current headline. So if someone's following their newspapers and TV and internet and seeing the development in Iran with the nonstop march toward nuclear weapons, and they're following the pronouncements from Iran against Israel, it should be something that really piques everyone's interest.
So you kind of stepped back, I guess, from the news and thought to yourself, how would an individual, you know, deal with a nuclear attack? An individual who, in this case, a nuclear submarine commander, and you don't even have any naval background. I mean, that's really taking on a huge challenge.
I definitely had to perform quite a bit of research, and it took a number of months to come up with the details. I looked at books, and I looked at internet articles and even blogs of submariners for sort of war stories that I could integrate into the title. And eventually, I had a draft of Depth of Revenge reviewed by a recently retired attack submarine sonar operator, and he told me that I'd gotten all the details, so I was quite proud to hear that.
Oh, that is. That is a commendation to you. Now, you talk about having this submarine commander to have to make decisions based on limited information and guidance. Now, why did you go that direction?
Well, a lot of decisions are made based on a committee where everyone is informed and has a report and knows what all the facts are. At least theoretically, things happen that way. But there are conditions where the leaders who are supposed to make those decisions are killed or incapacitated, and the decision falls to a lower-level authority. And in addition, information of cataclysmic events in particular and the beginnings of war is often inaccurate, and it takes some time to sort out the details. And then when you have a submarine, they're not always able to communicate with other authorities. They're usually only permitted to communicate maybe once a day. So it's really really a difficult situation for them.
And you also dealt with an issue of women aboard the submarine.
Yeah, I didn't really want to make that a dominating theme in the story, but I felt there was room for it without compromising the overall story. So I do have a female character in there, and it gives me a chance not only to directly address issues on the submarine as to how would this work and what would happen, but also to sort of take a look at what takes place in the general work environment. In other words, if you have a woman around, the workers are directed, well, just treat her like one of the guys, but you can't quite treat her like one of the guys. Don't think about her that she's here. But once you tell someone, don't think about something, that's all they're going to think about. So I was able to integrate that into the story. And the female character also ends up providing a lot of extra capabilities that probably without her, I wouldn't have given the submarine crew.
Well, set up this It Could Happen reality of the story. Kind of give us the overview setup of your book. What is happening? That, you know, when we first start reading, what are you drawing us into, this submarine adventure story?
Well, first, just a bit of background. Iran really is developing the nuclear weapons, and they're not about to be stopped by any sanctions or threats, and they're developing missiles with the range to reach not only Israel, but even into Europe. So that's really the starting point out of the headline. Then you combine that with the attitude of the Iranian leadership that, well, we don't care if we're killed as long as the hidden imam returns. And you can look again that the Iranian leadership isn't deterred by thoughts of death of their own citizens, because when they fought their war against Iraq a few years ago, they actually used their own teenagers to clear Saddam Hussein's minefield so that their vehicles could pass. So you've got this situation directed against Israel, which is about the size of the state of New Jersey, has certainly land-based aircraft and land-based missiles that can deliver a nuclear warhead, but these might not be survivable. So Israel has, in fact, acquired three modern German-built submarines that are believed themselves to have nuclear missile capability. And that's really out of the headline. And then to get into the story, then you have word of an attack against Israel, and at least initially very difficult communication with anyone in authority there, leaving the submarine commander in a position to potentially have to make decisions that should usually only be made by the prime minister or secretary of the Navy.
So we have a young submarine commander, too.
Right. From what I've been able to determine about the Israeli submarine commanders, they can be as young as age 31 or 32. So you have someone who's really not had much of a chance to mature and develop the perspective of an older person, plus with all their training is not very much equipped to deal with all of these details of how do you determine which nation is responsible for the attack and what are the proper sources to retaliate against. Most submarine commanders are just going to be very well trained to keep their submarine running very well, keep discipline, and to follow the orders, but they're not really nuclear war planners, per se.
Especially with incomplete information.
Right. You know, there's a lot of information that wouldn't be available after a nuclear attack. You might or might not be able to tell the trajectory of the missile, but who knows if your own nation has been tracking it and the area that has tracked the trajectory is destroyed. Can you get that information? Which nation supplied the missile, for instance? Which nation supplied the nuclear material that was in the detonation, and which nation supplied the technology? And is enough blame assigned based on these contributions or not?
So Israel does get attacked.
Yeah, well, that happens fairly early in the story. And as time passes, we get a chance to find out what's the nature of the damage, and we see how communications have been cut off. But everything passes through the mind of the commander. It's a story that I've written in the first person. So we have to actually wait for the commander to get a report brought by another crewman or receive some communications with elements of his government that have survived to actually find out bits and pieces and probabilities and possibilities.
So you're putting the reader right into the buck stops here commander role. They're going to be thinking right along with the commander.
Yes, I very often give a pretty detailed analysis of what's in the mind of the commander. He's usually got a lot of different alternatives, and he sort of gives us a chance to analyze each alternative, its pros and cons, and dismiss certain ideas. And this isn't just about the main question of how to retaliate, but even the sort of mundane personnel decisions and everyday decisions of what to do. And it gives a reader also a chance to say, you know, at this point, I disagree. You just need to give up at this point, or you should pull into port, or what are you waiting for? Now you should attack. So I really left a lot of information out there for the reader to second guess this commander.
And what kind of a time period does this book cover?
Well, the story really begins, you could almost say, tomorrow, but it takes place over a number of months. A submarine of the type that Israel has is really designed for shorter missions, and this mission ends up being quite a bit longer. So it takes place over a number of months, really, and it takes place underneath several different oceans. There's really a lot of geographical setup as the submarine moves from one point to the other as developments happen.
And there's something that happens, and a clerical error. We won't tell anybody what that is, but the whole story, is it kind of hinge on this mistake?
Yeah, the story, Death of Revenge, really has many different climaxes, but if there's one particular important point, a very small detail of a clerical error made at a lower level and not even made on the submarine itself ends up providing sort of the final link in the chain that allows for events to happen that would not have otherwise happened.
And you wanted to also make this very realistic, so you kind of went into details, didn't you, about nuclear weapons?
Yeah, I really had to do a lot of research to see if where I wanted to go was possible. And in doing that, I had to not only learn about what are the materials used in a weapon, but how does the explosion happen? What are the safeguards to prevent explosion? How is the warhead enabled? What are the mechanisms that prevent tampering with the warhead or would prevent someone who steals it from using it? And even I had to look at the toxicological effects or the radiological effects of what happens if you're actually exposed to the materials from the weapon. So in doing all this research, I was always kind of looking over my shoulder to see if the Department of Homeland Security wasn't going to come over and tap me on the shoulder there.
And you never received any kind of communication?
At least not to this point.
Not to this point.
We might get a few more readers and then they'll call on me or perhaps the Israeli Secret Service.
Well, tell us about some of the important characters that are allied with the commander, and he probably has some opponents as well, right on the submarine.
Yeah, now, the commander, I've given the name of Gilad, and he himself is really the primary character, and we can talk about him in a minute, but he's got a number of associates, really, that are helping him out, both officers and enlisted men, and some of them are quite colorful and should be familiar to readers because they're based on real-world kind of people. We've got a bodybuilder among the crew and someone who likes keeping neat, and we have a mechanic that doesn't really like to follow traditional safety manual and repair manual procedures, who thinks he knows more than the guy who wrote the book. And we've also got a man in there that's really a I-can-do-the-job kind of guy who doesn't back down in the face of overwhelming odds or difficulties, but just someone you can depend on. And in general, the crew members are supporting him, but we have eventually some that are opposing the commander.
I find it fascinating with authors who often will say the characters just came alive and they started talking. Now, when you were writing this book, it just kind of came alive, that what I hear from you.
Yes, I didn't really write a whole lot of dialogue. Instead, I was really giving the thoughts of the commander, but I found that using that first person was almost superior to dialogue as far as conveying the actual thoughts in a sort of compact manner. There is definitely some banter back and forth between the crew, but I try not to put in anything that's really distracting from the story. I try to keep overall distractions to a minimal.
I like what you said. There were times when I got the submarine and its crew into a predicament, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to write my way out of it.
Yes, I wrote Depth of Revenge without an outline. It's my first book, and I read somewhere.
My goodness.
If you're writing a first book, don't use an outline, just write. So I thought, okay, I've got license just to start writing and see where it goes. And as I wrote, I kind of reach a point where I'd say, okay, logically, but still in an exciting way, what would happen next? So I would write, and then at certain points, I would find, wow, I've gotten this crew in a lot of trouble. How can I get them out of their trouble? And I'd ask a friend, how can you get a submarine out of this situation? Or what kind of event on a submarine would cause this to happen? I'd get a little bit of help and continue writing. And at some points, I was actually surprised to see where the story went and how things I'd written earlier in the book enabled a more exciting middle or ending of the book.
And you did all this in a book with fewer than 200 pages.
Yes, I mean, I could have, I suppose, stretched it out and given more nuts and bolts details of how the submarine worked or how the systems worked, or added more details about minor characters that might have been amusing. But I really wanted to keep this a story-driven work rather than a character-driven work. So if there's any room for more adventure aboard the submarine, I would prefer that to simply describing some guy who had a scar on his face from a bar fight or whose wife was a real pest.
Any other closing thoughts, Richard?
Well, just that I've written the book really so that the issues would stay with the reader even after they put the story down, and they could even apply them to other threats such as those coming from North Korea or issues facing the United States from Iran. And I've also featured some American characters in the book, so it's really not purely an Israeli story.
How do we get your book, Richard?
It's available for order from any bookstore, and it's on the shelves of some Barnes & Noble stores. You can also contact my publisher, iUniverse, at 1-800-AUTHORS or at iUniverse.com, which is the only place to get the ebook. You can also visit BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com, or other online retailers. And finally, you can visit www.depthofrevenge.com for more information.
Well, fascinating story, very timely and very gripping and realistic. So congratulations, Richard.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for being on our radio show, and best to you. And is this the start of more?
I left the possibility for something from this story to carry on. It's not exactly a sequel, but at least some of the characters to carry on, or I might venture down a different road. I haven't really decided yet.
Well, thank you again. That was Richard Golden. He is the author of his book, Depth of Revenge.
You're listening to iUniverse Radio. We'll be back right after these messages.
East Texas Meals on Wheels needs your help. For the first time in 35 years, Meals on Wheels has a waiting list for meals. Currently, we serve more than 3,500 meals per day. With the help of donors and volunteers, we can eliminate the waiting list and serve more meals and ensure all who need a hot, nutritious meal are served. You can call our offices toll-free at 1-800-451-2912 to find out more about how you can help. You can also visit our website at www.mealsonwheelseasttexas.org. Again, toll free at 1-800-451-2912 or visit us on the web at www.mealsonwheelseasttexas.org. After all, when a person needs a meal, they need it today, not tomorrow. Thank you for helping Meals on Wheels.
Ever wondered how you can make a difference in someone's life when you don't have a lot of time or money to give? Well, the East Texas Crisis Center and Tyler Ford have partnered in a way that helps everyone. For just $10, you can win a limited edition autographed Shelby GT Mustang that has been donated to the Crisis Center by Tyler Ford. All the money stays right here in East Texas and helps victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. To get your ticket, call 903-579-2500. That's 903-579-2500.
Saturdays on TogiNap.com. It's Author Talk. Get the story behind the story on fiction and literature, graphic novels, horror, mystery and crime novels, romance, science fiction and fantasy, westerns, history, humor, inspiration, and every genre. It's all on Author Talk. You'll get to hear new authors talk about their books. Take the opportunity to hear insights on what inspired them to write it. It's called Author Talk on TogiNet.com. And it's presented by Author House, the leading provider of services to help authors publish, promote, and sell their book around the world. Author House has assisted more than 30,000 authors, producing over 40,000 titles. Author Talk with host Steve Jorgensen, every Saturday on TogiNet.com. Radio with a cutting edge.
Welcome back to iUniverse Radio with host Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Released to the Angels, with a subtitle, Discovering the Hidden Gifts of Alzheimer's. And the author is Marilyn Garzione, and she joins us now on iUniverse Radio. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi, how are you doing, Steve?
Tell us about this book. Obviously, it's about Alzheimer's, and it's a very, very, I'm sure, emotional thing to talk about because your husband suffered 6 to 7 years with extensive Alzheimer's,
right.
Correct?
That's correct.
And he's passed away, mm-hmm. and we're really sorry that that's happened as well. Tell us about what motivated you to write this book.
Well, you know, I think we all know that Alzheimer's is a horrible, it's a devastating disease, and there are things that are easy to see. We can see the pain, and we certainly can see the loss, but I think it's harder to see and harder to believe that there could ever be anything positive within Alzheimer's. As you were saying, my husband Patrick had Alzheimer's, and throughout the years that we were together, I learned that, yes, in any overwhelming situation, whether it's a disease or an emotional loss, there is sadness and there is grief, but our story is more of a message that in our lives there are really positive gifts that are all around us.
All right, you use the word gifts. Now, that's some people might say, how do you talk about gifts with Alzheimer's or anything else that is so debilitating? Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by gifts?
Well, gifts, they're almost rediscoveries of things that really are a part of our lives and everyday health that give us strength and help us cope. And I think that they are always around us, even when we are healthy. But when we're healthy, they can go missed completely because our focus is elsewhere. In health, we make goals. We have accomplishments from our jobs and what we do, and we certainly can take comfort from our loved ones. But when you have something like Alzheimer's going on, many of these sources absolutely just vanish. We can't make goals. We're faced with losses, not accomplishments. And it's very hard to go to our loved ones because most often they are the ones that are sick and they need our comfort. So these sources of strength, or these gifts, as I call them, I think they are always there. But I think they take on more importance and more significance when something catastrophic is going on, because now they become the very source where we can find our strength.
So your whole paradigm changes.
I think so. I think by nature, it becomes a consequence of the disease, yes. Your perspective certainly changes. Many of the things that you know about Alzheimer's to begin with are absolutely true. But when you get into it, when you're looking at it from the inside out, other things are revealed as well.
Now, you talk about measuring time in a different way, in a better way.
Right. Now,
so what do you mean by that?
Well, I think the common way of measuring time, and we tend to do this in health, is that we're always looking forward to someday. Someday we're going to travel, we're going to build onto the house, whatever. But there is no someday anymore, and it really teaches you at this disease that you have to start measuring time in a different way. And I found that it is a gift. There's a gift to living in the now if we're willing to experience that simplicity of seeing what's in front of us instead of always looking ahead into things in the future. It's a hard thing to do, very hard, and it's not a constant thing. But I think we could all benefit from that, of learning to live in the now.
Some people have a very difficult time with adversity and won't accept it, or they get mad at God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did you go through?
I think I went through all of that. I think that's a part of being human. I did. I reacted some days with great sadness, and I reacted with joy. And I think that when I look over my life, I've been happy and I've been sad. I just prefer happy. So I think that it was a matter of trying to find things that could edify me and try to find things that could sustain me. And I found that the good moments, the moments of humor, the moments of joy, were far better to hang on to than the things that were hard to handle, the negative.
Well, there's nothing funny about Alzheimer's.
Absolutely.
So where do you find the humor?
Well, I think whether you have disease going on or whether you have health, there are always moments around. I think it's a matter of perspective. I think it comes down to changing our perspective, that we are surrounded by moments of joy, and we're surrounded by moments of sadness. We're surrounded by all sorts of moments that we can experience. And it's a matter of changing our focus and having that choice, because I don't think Alzheimer's gives you much of a choice. It is controlling what it's going to do. The only thing we can possibly control is how we react to this disease, and we do have the choice of hanging on to positive moments that can help us.
So who does your book appeal to? What group would really benefit besides mm-hmm. just people who are taking care of Alzheimer's patients and family?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily aiming solely at people with Alzheimer's or healthcare givers. But this disease, as well as any other big-time disease of cancer or any other loss, we are faced with how do we face anything that is hard? How do we cope with this? How can we find life going on within this disease? And I think that is a main message of what I am doing, especially with Alzheimer's. I'm only now learning, because when you're actually having Alzheimer's within the four walls of your home, you're only surviving. You're just trying to figure out a way out of this. I'm only now beginning to learn the statistics that the Alzheimer's, over 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's. And I've been told that every 71 seconds someone is diagnosed. That to me is just incredible.
Yes.
And baby boomers,
probably going to get worse for the baby boomers.
Yeah, and I'm included. We're going to face this very soon. And some of us,
I was born in 46, so I'm one of the early ones.
Ditto.
Yes.
And I think that we are now caring for elderly parents, and some even belong to, I think they call it the sandwich generation, of caring for both parents and children at the same time. So family members are searching for strength and answers and something that will help give them encouragement and give meaning to what they're going through. I think that my book will appeal to health care givers, family members, and anyone facing personal loss, because it is a message that you can still find moments. They're not going to be big moments, but the little moments are just fine. You can hang on to those. Those have strength.
Now, your book is really a book of entries. Now, explain, you know, what that means.
Yes. When I first wrote about this, started writing the entries, it was done basically for me, my own therapy, built-in therapy. I only had a few minutes every morning before Patrick was awake.
So it was like a journal to begin with.
Absolutely. It started like that. And I found that if I had a moment that to me was humorous or something that caught my attention, when I wrote it down, it seemed to have more power. It seemed to have more strength. And so if I wrote down something that I laughed about the day before and put it on paper, I could remember it. It became something concrete. It became something real. So that during that day or the days following, if I had a particularly hard moment, a moment that was very difficult, I could think back on those moments. It sort of became a little collection of favorite things, a collection of moments of strength that I could rely on because everything else was going crazy around me.
So you've broken the book down into four different segments, right? Mm-hmm. Stages, if you will. Like at the first one says, looking back from now. And as I look down this list of entries, they're all titled. And I'm just kind of, I was going to pick out something here that, oh, clean shaven. Now, what was that about? Clean shaven entry.
Well, you have to be very careful. You know, they always say, be careful, be careful what you wish. And I have to add, please be careful what you say, because I always felt that he needed to still maintain his dignity by shaving. And I would simply say, hon, okay, you're ready to shave. Make sure that you make everything smooth. And I would then give him his privacy. And on this particular occasion, I came back, and he had definitely shaved with electric shaver, but he had he'd taken it a little bit too far, and he was heading up north, and there was hair all over. He ended up looking like a Benedictine monk is what he ended up looking like.
So he was going to just go shave his head.
Huh? He was going to follow what I told him to do, so that was
oh,
that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You know, it's, I'm sure, you know, it's funny to look back on, but that's,
It is, but that's the thing. I think right. You have to release yourself. You have to give yourself permission to laugh, too, because you can't. I mean, obviously, that could set you in the other direction, but
sure.
To me, I just found humor in that.
Right. And then you go into the second section is called Early Stages. Mm-hmm. It begins. So we're talking about these when you really started to understand, you saw the extensiveness of it?
I did. The first section of the book is looking back over our lifetime to the years of health, how we met, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Then I should add here that my father also had Alzheimer's. He died with Alzheimer's, and Pat was a very close friend of my father's. So when it came to the diagnosis of Pat, it was, I knew what I was in for, and so did he, and we sort of entered into this together. But that first section, and then is dealing with coming to grips with the disease itself. And
yeah,
there's
one entry called Scared.
Yes. It was one of the times that I realized that he was suffering from losses, and I came home from school one day to find that there was blood on the carpet and a note that had all these misspellings that I couldn't hunt him down in the hospitals. Turned out that he had tried to repair something with a pair of box cutters and had cut himself, but he was waiting for me outside for me to come home so he'd go to hospital, and somebody had told him, no, you've got to have help. And it was the first time that he hadn't taken steps to help himself, and it was a realization that I had to step in, and it was time. And I think for healthcare givers, there is that, when do you step in to help your loved one? When you don't want to take their dignity away from them, their pride. And this book deals with those moments as well. It has.
But there's a line that's called safety, right?
Right. And I think that it's very hard for us as healthcare givers, and it's such a unique experience that each one of us is going through. And we can learn to help our loved ones, but we also have to take care of ourselves. It's a very complicated situation. But my message is that there are redeeming moments that we can hang on to. And it is a collection of, the book is a collection of humorous anecdotes and thoughts and observations as we went through this together. I don't think it's a Pollyannish book. It certainly deals with some heavy issues, but it is more of a choice. It's a lesson that we can choose to focus on what can give us the strength.
Like the time you were in the supermarket.
Yes.
Tell us that story.
We were in the supermarket, and there were lines in front of us and in back of us. And I wasn't really paying attention to him, but he definitely was paying attention to the shopping cart in back of him. And he spotted a gallon of chocolate ice cream, which was his favorite, and he simply reached in and put it into our cart. And the poor lady. I mean, he didn't.
Right in front of her, right?
He was a grown man. He didn't look sick, and she just didn't know what to do. So
oh,
it was,
goodness.
But those are the times. But it also then leads to conversations, and
sure.
it was a good thing.
Yeah.
I chuckled.
Well, those are the, you know, those are the funny moments, but mm-hmm. The embarrassing moments all rolled
they
into
are.
One.
Well, you have to give that up. Things are going to happen. And there's one thing
there you go.
High on the list is that you cannot control another person's behavior. And if things are going to happen, and they're going to happen in public, and you've got to learn to laugh. There is so much strength in laughter, and it will it'll carry you through.
Well, and you say that this book is not a guide, but it's really a story of two people who find the strength and love to face this thing together. That really sums it up, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
I think so. I think that when you enter into any disease, whether it's cancer, whether it's heart disease, I think your relationship, if it is strong to begin with, Alzheimer's certainly will not improve a relationship. You have to have, if you have a strong relationship going into this disease, I think your chances are better to be able to accept and go through this. But there was. With us, we had a very good relationship going into this, and it step by step. I'm a far stronger person now than what I was before this began. I would never recommend going through this to gain the strength that I did, but I've learned a tremendous amount.
So how did you cope?
Well, you try, first of all, you can cry. I found the car to be very good. Close up the windows and drive and cry. That helps. I had a tremendous support system of friends. In all honesty, I didn't reach out probably as I should. I sometimes hid my needs. And what I'm encouraging people now is to really reach out to friends that can help you, that can give you support. You cannot do this alone. And very, very high on the list is the wonderful things that the Alzheimer's Association is doing. I am so impressed with the outreach programs they're doing to train and give support and help to family caregivers. They even have a 24-hour hotline. I somewhere around here I have that number. Would you mind me giving that to your listeners?
Please.
Here it is. It's 1-800-272-3900. 1-800-272-3900. And they are incredible people. They just do a wonderful job in offering advice and programs to help family members cope. And I encourage anybody.
And they've read your book.
And
they like it.
And they like it.
They gave you a beautiful review.
Right. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to be speaking at a conference. And they are just very supportive of me, but just wonderfully positive people. It's just wonderful.
Well, I think what you're saying is people have to learn to reach out, and they have to learn to probably do what you did. This was therapy, wasn't it, writing these entries?
It definitely was therapy. And but also to know that you do not have to be all strong. You do not have to have the answers to how to face this. There are times that you're not going to be strong, and that's okay. And if you can't find the strength within you, then to reach out to others and use their strength. And it's a lesson I think all of us can learn.
Marilyn, tell us how to get your book.
Well, Dick, you certainly can order it from Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. You can also, and I would encourage anybody to go to my website, which is releasedtotheangels.com. And it has a link there to order the book, as well as tips for things that I have learned for the family health caregiver, pictures of Patrick and myself, and the Alzheimer's Association trips to Washington, D.C., that sort of thing.
Well, Marilyn, we want to thank you for being on iUniverse Radio.
Well, I thank you for giving me this great opportunity to speak.
That was Marilyn Garzione. She is the author of her book, Released to the Angels, Discovering the Hidden Gifts of Alzheimer's.
You're listening to iUniverse Radio. We'll be back right after these messages.
He's a diehard American. He's Wright, and he has the last name to prove it. He's Jason Wright, the host of The Wright Side of the Aisle on TogiNet Radio. Jason is a father and self-made entrepreneur who turned a struggling East Texas real estate firm into a top-notch million-dollar company. Jason Wright loves America and is very concerned about where we are headed as a nation. He's dedicated to traditional American values. Jason Wright. Join us every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern for The Wright Side of the Aisle on TogiNet.com. Maybe if I write a book, it will be the thing that keeps me alive.
Those are the troubled words of a new 16-year-old author with her first thought-provoking book, What Gives?, published by Togi Entertainment. The author kept a diary during her dark teenage times, which turned into a 360-page suicide note with a happy ending. Texas Monthly describes teen author Chelsea Marie and her new book, What Gives?, in this provocative way. We've plunged from page to page, not because of the young diarist's despondency. Depression is not especially attractive or compelling, but because we are fascinated to see that while she is fending off demons on one hand, she is writing verse with the other. What Gives is available at whatgivesbook.com and national bookstores. Readers of What Gives are giving rave reviews. All social scientists, teachers, and students should use this book as a learning tool. What Gives is available at whatgivesbook.com and national bookstores.
Welcome back to iUniverse Radio with host Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Safe Harbor, and the co-authors are Leonard Howard and David Duranian. And Leonard and David join us now on iUniverse Radio. Hello, gentlemen.
Yeah, hi.
Good to have you on the show. So, Leonard, why don't we start with you? You kind of give us an overview of the book and then why the two of you wrote it.
Yes, it's an adventure novel, and we wanted to discuss the make people aware of the Armenian problem that Armenia actually exists. And because not many people do know this, and the other thing that bad things happened in 1915 to the Armenians. There's been a lot of documentaries on the subject, and a lot of the stories preach to the believers, you know, other Armenians. And we felt that it'd be nice to tell the world in the form of an adventure novel that these things happened.
So we're talking about the Armenian genocide.
That's correct. Correct. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, David.
Well, if I might just interject, based on what Len said there, you know, my perspective is coming at it. I'm really trying to address those two questions from the position of family history. My grandfather was orphaned because of that genocide. He lost his mother and father, and younger brother and younger sister. And this was something that, as growing up, even as a very, very young boy, I remember the stories and just the sadness from my grandfather and other Armenians of his generation. And so I really was coming from a perspective of trying to impart that emotion that I grew up with and that's now going on three generations, actually.
Leonard, where is Armenia for everyone to kind of get it in their mind, see the picture of where Armenia is located?
That's a good question. It's east of present-day Turkey. And to the east of Turkey, you have Armenia, and then to the east of Armenia, you have Azerbaijan. And north of Armenia is Georgia. It's essentially an area known as the Caucasus, which also made the job of writing this book as something unique in that not many people write adventure novels about that area. Part of eastern Turkey was actually historic Armenia at one time. And Rob, can you follow on that?
Sure. Yeah, essentially that region of what is today eastern Turkey, historically that was the homeland of the Armenians for some 3,000 years. You can go back to all the ancient maps and you see there was an Armenian, there's a country of Armenia, Armenian presence there. They have an ancient culture. It's their religion is Christianity. They were very much tied in with the Romans going way back and then Europe and all the different civilizations. But the tough thing about Armenia was it happened to be situated in an area where the empires were always rolling through. And finally, of course, the last empire that ruled it was the Ottoman Turkish Empire. And, of course, That was, as that empire fell, that spelled the demise of the region known as Armenia and the Armenian people that lived in that region. So today, effectively, in eastern Turkey, there's essentially no Armenians left. And before 1915, there were upwards of about 3 million Armenians in that land.
It was also typical of other places where more than one type of people shared the land. You had the Kurds and the Turks and the Armenians sharing the same land. And at one time, being able to get on with each other, but that later on, they fell out and they all claimed the same land.
So why kill off all the Armenians? What was the was it just a religious prejudice, or was it more political than that?
If I might, well, I think it's a very complicated answer to some extent. It's really, some people would say that primarily it was religious. I mean, certainly on the ground, I've heard scholars say that on the ground, it was about religion. That is, you know, the Turkish population, the Kurdish population primarily were, I mean, if not primarily, completely were of the Muslim faith, the Islamic faith. That's not to say that people of the Islamic faith always want to, you know, do Christians in. It's not the case. But during that particular time period in that region, there was a real competition going on. It's effectively, the Armenians were experiencing a renaissance of their culture. They were Christian people. They were becoming very educated. They were doing well in business. Really, they were this minority that was doing quite well, both intellectually and economically, and that doesn't spell well for them, given that they were surrounded by people of a different faith that weren't doing so well at that time in that particular region. And so part of it, again, was religious. Another part of it was political. The Turkish regime at the time that had taken over the Ottoman Empire, this was right during World War I. They were called the Young Turks, and their empire was crumbling. The Ottoman Empire was falling apart. It was on its last throes, and these Young Turks, who were really precursors to the Nazis in some sense, envisioned a pan-Turkish empire which stretched from Istanbul in the west all the way to China in the east. That this empire would unite all the Turkic peoples in Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, all these places. And what were the one people that were right in the middle of all this? It was the Armenians.
And most of these people were of Muslim faith?
Correct. Primarily they were of a Muslim faith, yes.
So it's not unlike like Israel, surrounded, you know, by all the Arabs today. You know, different faiths and different levels of education and not being able to come to agreement to live together.
It's important to note here that in many cases, however, these people would get along on an individual level. For example, my family, in a previous massacre that happened in 1896, not as large scale as the genocide, was actually saved by a Turkish family, which we can assume was Islamic. So, you know, on an individual level, people treated each other with decency. You hear lots of stories like that. I mean, it certainly wasn't always the case either. In my family, they had Kurdish friends and Turkish friends. But, you know, when the government got involved, and what would happen is some of these very radical imams, similar to what we see today in these radical Islamic terrorists, they would fire up the people and, you know, come on, let's, you know, get these people, because let's get their lands. They don't deserve to be here. One of the things that they did with the Armenians was they characterized them as not human, which is just kind of a precursor to what happens in genocide. If you can get the people to think that the ones you're killing are not really human, they're more like animals, then go ahead and do it. In fact, one of the terms for the Armenians that they used to call, the Armenians was raya, which means cattle.
Hard to believe that people can think of that way of other human beings and justify it, you know?
Yes.
Leonard, tell us about one of the main characters, John. Now, how do you pronounce his last name?
John
Avedizin? I can't say it.
Avedian. Yeah. A young boy who sees his family massacred and tries to save his sister, and his sister is lost to him. He tries to help his sister through an area, but unfortunately the people following them and doing the killing grab the sister, and he has to continue because there are a lot of people following him. His mother had asked him to look after his sister, and he felt the conscience of that all through his life. The story takes us into 1944, where he meets a gentleman called Turkin and asks the gentleman to go and look for his sister. And the main part of the story is to do with finding the sister. In Turkin traveling through England, goes to Spain, and then finally to Turkey, and starts to search for her.
So unfortunately, this was your novel circumstance probably fit a lot of real life situations because families got separated.
Yeah, very much, very much.
And a lot of cases, certainly for the Armenians, is they didn't have closure. They didn't know what happened to their families. It's happened also with the Jewish people. I'm Jewish, and that's why I was attracted to this story. Because when Hitler was about to kill the Jews, he said that, listen, he told, this is a true story, and no one really did anything about the Armenians, so he could do what he liked about the Jews. And we see it today, that the present genocides follow the same kind of pattern. We all write about it and feel sorry, but we never do anything.
Any thoughts, David?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what Len says is just dead on, and I think that, in fact, in my own family, I remember there was a picture that used to circulate, and it was of my grandfather's mother and father and younger brother and younger sister that simply disappeared. Not a trace. You know, all of a sudden the letter stopped, and that was it, and if you talk with most Armenians in the diaspora today, in the United States and all different countries, this was so typical that it's just a really common story. Typically, maybe, you know, one half of the family would get out somehow by some circumstance. The other family would simply be lost. Some of those we know went to, some of the kids were adopted either by force or by choice, taken by Turkish and Kurdish parents, and then they were absorbed into the population. Others were just killed outright, made into slaves. There's a picture that comes to mind that was dated around 1920, and it has a picture of this young Armenian girl, probably about 15 years old, and she has tattoos all over her body. And it's the headline reads, $2 will buy this pretty young Armenian girl. I mean, that was the brutality. Yeah. That was the level that they had sort of gone to.
My goodness.
Yeah.
My goodness. So these characters, in the midst of all this trauma and separation, part of your story is their search for meaning.
Very much.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's search for meaning and going back to try and find the sister. And as we pursue the adventure of the story, we explain to people about these happenings. It's in a kind of an easier way than just reading history, just full history.
So do Turkish people try to help them to reconnect?
There were occasions in the story, certainly, where that happened, and I think that were actually realistic. There's one character, for example, that they run into a woman who's in charge of an orphanage. If I should mention, there's a Kerrigan character, this Kerrigan that Lynn had alluded to. He's really the centerpiece of the story, actually. And if you will, he's kind of an Armenian James Bond with a lot of inward troubles because his family has also suffered. But as he's searching for the sister, her name is Anna, he meets a Turkish woman who really takes pity on the Armenian children, and she doesn't care if the children are Turkish or whoever they are, or Armenian, whatever. She just cares about the children. There's another big component to the story later on where there are some Turkish foreign service agents, and you mentioned the idea of meaning in this story, and really this is a story not just about the Armenian experience but also the Turkish experience, that these Turkish agents find themselves right in the middle of, on the one hand, trying to do what's, you know, in the best interest of their nation and their job, which is Turkish secret service agents, but on the other hand, dealing with issues of their own humanity, their own ideas of what's right and what's wrong. And really, this story, I think this is where the real power of the story comes out. It is about identity. It's about people that, you know, probably could be friends in a different life, but they're pitted in this situation which is uncomfortable for them, and they have to somehow fulfill the roles that have been given to them, and yet at the same time they have to try and strive for their own personal meaning and what it means to be human, actually. And the story really interweaves all these different characters and causes them to have to make some tough decisions.
The breadth of the story covers from 1915 to present day, where the John has been very successful in America and wants to do good things for Armenia. But there's a lot of people who want to stop him, including his family, which he subsequently had.
Well, it sounds like quite an adventure with quite a historical theme. I'm sure it was a great challenge to keep the historical theme true.
luckily, David is has a lot of knowledge of the history. I was the plot part of it.
Well, fantastic. You sound like you worked as a good team on this. And tell us how to get your book.
The book's available from pretty well everywhere, including Amazon.com. We have our own site called NYRIBooks.com. That's N for Nancy, Y-R-I, books.com. They're available from Barnes & Noble, pretty well everywhere. We've really just released it, and we're starting a little campaign. We're talking to our publicist this morning, and we try to get everybody. This is not just aimed at Armenians. It's for everybody to read. It's, some people call it a page turner. We haven't made it very difficult to read.
Sounds like a movie script.
That will be the next step.
Great. Well, good for you, and best to you. We want to thank you both for being on iUniverse Radio.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
That was Leonard Howard and David Duranian. They are the authors of their book, Safe Harbor.
iUniverse Radio is brought to you by iUniverse, the leading book marketing, editorial services, and supported self-publishing company. iUniverse Radio is produced by TogiNet Radio. Radio with a cutting edge.